Welcome to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's podcast series, Paths to On-Farm Excellence, where we discuss priority topics for Canadian dairy farmers. My name's Stephen Roach. I'm an epidemiologist with a passion for dairy cattle health and welfare. I did my master's and PhD trying to understand how farmers, their staff, and their advisors can work together as a team to improve. I'm also part of a team working with the Dairy Farmers of Canada to help showcase Canadian dairy farming stories, industry updates, and the latest science, advice, and perspectives on high-priority topics that relate to ProAction. You'll find this channel features a number of different series, from environmental sustainability to animal care to biosecurity and beyond. This podcast series features conversations with farmers, veterinarians, and other farm advisors, researchers, and many other industry stakeholders. Our goal is ultimately to provide farmers and their advisors with useful information that can be applied back home on the farm. If you like the content here, don't forget to subscribe to our feed and tell your friends. Soil health is critical for the success of a farm and to protect the environment. Healthy soil has a host of benefits, including better nutrient and water retention, better crop health, and ultimately higher productivity. I sat down with an expert from the Government of Manitoba to discuss big topics related to soil health: erosion, compaction, building soil carbon, and how you can implement practices to improve soil health on your farm. So let's jump in. Well, Marla, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and chat with me today. Really excited to dig into all facets, really, of soil health. So thanks so much for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. Looking forward to the conversation.
So I've introduced you a little bit already, but just for the opportunity for us to kind of get to know each other a little bit, tell me a little bit about yourself, your role. How'd you get into soil health in general, and where do you sit today?
Ah, good question. So I work for Manitoba Agriculture. I am a soil management specialist. I've been doing this position or this job since 2010. And a lot of things around soil management has, like, we often talk about soil quality and stuff back in the day, and then soil health became the new word that people were talking about. And so that just kind of seemed to be where things morphed over time. And really, though, I mean, a lot of what we talk about is still things that are related to quality, but we give it a bit of a different feel when we start talking about it as like soil health as opposed to just soil quality parameters. So yeah, I've been doing it a little while and really love doing anything to do with soil, really passionate about it. And I love being able to work with farmers of all different areas because soil is that foundation. So it's always a great part of getting involved in any kind of an agricultural production because everything depends on the soil.
No kidding. Well, let's talk about that a little bit in terms of, you know, I guess a definition of soil health or what are we really talking about when we use that kind of term and how, you know, maybe a bit of insight into how that's evolved. And I guess we probably don't need to belabor this for farmers, but you want to talk about why this is so important?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about things like soil health in terms of what it is, we always talk about soil with that perfect Venn diagram, right, of soil physical, chemical, and biological processes and them working together. And essentially how those three intersect on that Venn diagram, that is where we kind of think about soil health sitting. So that in a health system, you're trying to kind of integrate or incorporate or look at all of these things and how they function together in order to support whatever it is we're trying to do with the soil. And farmers know a lot of the times what's important to them in terms of soil health, right? Obviously, production is a big thing. So the fact that we need to have some kind of production productivity from the soil, but that comes from those three factors working together. We can sometimes kind of pull out one or the other as being more important. And sometimes that may depend on what the issue is that we're battling, right? So if you're dealing with, say, a compaction issue, we think about compaction issues as being really related to soil physical structures and physical processes. And they can then impact the chemical and biological function of the soil too. But then in that case, if you're looking to try to fix something, you're looking at that root cause or that root problem, which is the physical part of the soil. So we always consider all three of those when we're dealing with it as kind of soil health from that holistic or bigger picture process, but we still have to be able to dig down into each of those issues independently.
Yeah, that's great. And very visual in terms of just thinking about the different elements that do come together. So, you know, when we think about soil health and some of the big topics that are related to it that, you know, the royal we seem to be talking about a lot these days from a research lens, from a practical lens, you know, getting out in the field and talking about real issues, real problems today, we still mm-hmm. hear lots and see lots about soil erosion. You've already mentioned compaction. So I think it'd be, you know, interesting to talk a little bit more about that. And then something that's newer to me anyway is building soil carbon and talking a little bit more about that is also a crucial piece as I've done reading and talked with folks as well. If we kind of break some of those down and maybe talk about erosion first, just to choose one, can you talk to me a little bit about, you know, how we know what's happening, you know, if we need to qualify what we're talking about when we're specifically talking about soil erosion, by all means, take that away as well. But yeah, let's get into erosion a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So if we're talking about things like soil erosion, this is stuff we can sometimes just see, right? We can, if there's a wind erosion event happening, and yes, we get these events that happen occasionally, especially if we're dealing with, you know, dry soils, soils that have been very kind of well tilled, don't have a lot of kind of the aggregates are really small, soil particles have broken off and the wind picks up and it can blow away. We see that happening. When we can see ridges and rills left behind in the soil, if water has eroded. And I know, like, we had some very extreme in Manitoba anyway, we had some very extreme water erosion events happening last summer because we had some really big wind or rain events and lots of areas where soils were washing away, right? Those are extreme events. Sometimes they're not the norm from an erosion standpoint. That's something we can see. There's also tillage erosion. And tillage erosion, we eventually see, but we don't see it necessarily happening in the moment, the way that we can see water moving soil away or wind blowing soil away. Tillage erosion is often happening when you're moving equipment up and over and down a slope and it drags soil from the top to the bottom. And over time, when you look at those hillier landscapes, you start to see this area at the top of the hill where you have very light subsoil showing because the topsoil has actually been dragged off or eroded off the top of the soil. So you do get a visual impact of that as well, but you're not seeing it in the moment. You see it kind of after the fact, after it's kind of built up. So all three of those things, wind, water, and tillage, are all kind of potentially erosive activities. Wind and water isn't necessarily an activity, but you get what I'm saying about that. So all of these events or things can happen, and all of those can impact whether or not topsoil is staying where it developed. And if the topsoil isn't staying where it developed, then we have to figure out what is a strategy to kind of decrease that from happening, or is there any way we can actually repair it after the fact as well?
Yeah, interesting. So two questions from me. First one is impact. So if we're seeing mm-hmm. soil erosion, how's that affecting things like productivity, maybe sustainability in the long run? You know, how do we quantify and speak to impact here?
So there are things like soil loss tolerance, where if you have a thick topsoil, you can actually tolerate a certain amount of soil loss and it doesn't actually decrease productivity that quickly, right? So you could take away, you know, the thickness of a dime off of your topsoil and you're not going to notice that. And that doesn't mean that we should tolerate fully all soil loss, but it is something that we think about that, you know, if it's a little bit of loss, you're not actually going to see that in terms of an overall impact. Once you start losing that topsoil, and this is where tillage erosion, the reason why we always bring that one up is that tillage actually moves more soil than any of those other things in most cases. And so when you start to see that topsoil is gone because you have this, you know, light subsoil left at the surface, that is when you start to see a decrease in productivity. And sometimes we just start to blame, oh, you know, it's dry up on those knolls. Crop doesn't grow very well just because it's not, you know, getting a lot of moisture. And we blame all these things, but we forget about the fact that we might have been able to hold more moisture if we had some topsoil at that top anyway. So, you know, it's hard to kind of measure, quantify a full impact. Some of these things can have very, very little impact. And some of these types of like major erosion events can have some large impact. You know, like the water erosion events we had last summer in Manitoba, some of these things left big gullies in fields and you're not farming that anymore. And now you have to get around it to get to the other side of the field. And so those things can have major impacts on how we then farm. But again, those are thankfully less common than what we would normally see in a normal year.
Sure. So what can we, I mean, it's going to be no surprise, I assume, that we're going to talk about no-till as a way to control erosion. But I guess, you know, maybe we can dig into deeper on that, but also maybe think more holistically about if we've got farmers listening here and are saying, okay, you know, what are my options here? Yeah. What kind of things, you know, practically speaking, should our farmers be looking at here?
Yeah. So if you're trying to protect yourself from erosion occurring, decreasing tillage. So no-till is great. No-till doesn't work in every situation that easily. Fully understand that, and I appreciate that. Decreasing tillage, though, and moving to min-till or being strategic in tillage. So rather than just tilling every acre the same, maybe thinking about what crop it is that you are following, what crop is going into that seedbed, and being a bit strategic in terms of how you do tillage and how much tillage and what type of tillage you end up bringing into the situation. When it comes to, you know, that's preventing further erosion. When it comes to actually fixing or dealing with erosion that's already happened, especially with something like tillage erosion, where you have those eroded knolls, those higher level areas where there's no topsoil back there, you can actually put the topsoil back. So it's a practice we call soil landscape restoration. And you actually go through and you go to the bottom of the hill where all of that topsoil has been deposited, and you scrape it up and you put it back on the top of the hill. And it seems so simplistic, and it actually is. If you think about it in theory, it's pretty simple. It takes a bit of time, obviously, and it takes some expense to have to move soil around like that. But what's really interesting is that Dr. David Laub at the University of Manitoba has done a fair bit of work on this. And back in like the mid-aughts, they were doing some work. They looked at the return on investment, and they found that if you assumed that it was a custom operator that was actually moving the soil back up, which farmers can do it a lot cheaper if they've got the equipment to do it themselves, the return on investment was somewhere between 3 and 5 years. And so that's pretty fast for a land management activity. And so you can go through that and you're going to get your money back because of the fact that now you have got productivity back on that top knoll area at the top of the hill. And so you're gaining more yield, which is fantastic. The great part about that, after you've moved the soil back, now you adopt no-till or a minimum till, and you basically stop the bleed again, right? You're going to stop doing it. But if you continue tilling, they found that, you know, in 15 years or so, it pays to do it again, because obviously you will continue to drag the soil back down because it's tillage is happening, but it does pay to do this. And this is not a new practice. There's pictures from like the 1800s of people doing this in France and things, and it's not new. It's really not rocket science, the idea of just putting soil back where it came from, but it is new to a lot of farmers in terms of not being a practice that we see a lot of people do, but I hope we get more people engaged in it in the future.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And appreciate the return on investment comments too. And you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's quite impactful, especially stacked up to some of these other land management practices you hear.
Yeah.
So really, really cool. Let's leave erosion for a moment and jump into compaction. You've already sort of brought that up a little bit as an issue. So, you know, talk to us about characteristics of compaction, signs, you know, what are we looking for? What's evidence of it? And maybe we can chat a little bit about impacts as well.
Yeah. So some of the signs of compaction we end up seeing quite often is things like wheel track compaction, or areas where you can actually see, especially if you see aerial imagery where, you know, you've got these tracks running through a field, everything's green, but you've got these yellower strips or things that show up as a bit more stunted because the crop isn't growing as well. And it visually shows as this is where we've been driving through the field, right? So it's nice to know that, yeah, you can see that impact. We don't always quantify what that impact is from a yield perspective. And so we don't always have a good idea on what the overall yield impact will be from things like compaction, but we visually see it and we know that the impact is there, but it's hard to kind of quantify it without going into every track. And there are ways to go in and actually compare like in a track and out of a track and basically look at the area of the field and how much area of that was covered by track and be able to see some things. I know some of my colleagues at the University of Minnesota were seeing things like 16%, you know, yield reductions in things like corn. in a track versus out of a track. And that can be significant if you think of how many kind of wheel tracks are across a field. And things like wheel tracks, we don't think about how much we traffic a field until you see those visual impacts. When we talk about compaction, the rule of thumb we always say is 80% of compaction happens in the first pass. And how they come to that number is that they looked at passing over the same track four times in a row. And after four times of compaction, like compacting the soil, they measure the total compaction. And they said, we're going to call this a relative 100% compaction. 80% of that happened in the first pass. And the next 20% came from pass two, three, and four. So that shows the impact of just one track across the field, one time trafficking across the field has a big impact. I could drive over that two, three, four more times, and I'm only going to add an extra 20% essentially to that overall impact. So when farmers are spending time going across a field, trafficking the field, this is a lot of times is at things like harvest, right? When we're meeting a combine and going through, that is usually when we have a high risk of a lot of things like compaction happening because we're crisscrossing the field as opposed to going up and down it. So we often remind people when you're going out with grain carts, you know, drive up the previous combine path and then just veer off when it's time to unload and then get back on the track and go to the headlands and then you can drive off in the headlands just to try to minimize some of the actual footprint of equipment. When we think about, you know, the good things about or how to manage compaction, quite often we think about things like perennial crops. They're super helpful because now we have a period of time when we've got all these roots growing. They can help break up the, you know, the field. You know, things like alfalfa, they really kind of help to kind of carry some of the load too of the equipment. So there's lots of things to factor into things like compaction. It's a complicated thing. And yet it is pretty simple. Decrease the pressure on the soil, you decrease the overall compaction.
Is there anything to the soil characteristics that make it more or less sort of subject to compaction? Is that something Absolutely. That we should be worrying about? Like as a farmer, are you going to manage at that level or it is what it is?
No, absolutely. So traveling on the soil when it is moist, so near field capacity, basically, at that point, all of the pores in the soil that are small are holding water and all the big ones have drained out. And the big ones are now subject to crushing or compacting. There's enough moisture in the soil that soil can kind of slide around on itself. So it allows for the movement of the soil. So the equipment goes over, it crushes down. That's when we're at the highest risk. When our soil is really dry, we have very low risk of compaction because the soil isn't going to slide or move as much. When it is fully saturated and every pore is full of water, that's when we have a lower risk of compaction. Now, we also cause really big ruts and ugly things in the field because we're sliming around in the soil. But the water that's in the soil actually helps to protect it. So yeah, we're messing with the surface soil structure when we create those big ruts, but down below, it's actually sort of protected by all the water that's in the soil. So field capacity or when that soil is moist, that is the absolute worst time. Of course, we can't always not go on the field just because it's a high risk of compaction. So that's why I always say when we're in that situation where we know we're in a high risk of compaction, then make the decisions you can to decrease or mitigate the risk. You know, make sure your tires are run at their rated pressure as low as they can be rated for a field situation. So not road pressure, but field rated pressures. Using tracks can be helpful. Duals and tracks are very similar in terms of their actual impact for compaction, but tracks can have some benefits for slippage. So using duals, using tracks, whatever it is that you can do to decrease that, and then decreasing the random traffic across the field and focusing traffic in the same spot. So it's really just saying, I know I'm going to cause a problem. What do I do to decrease the problem as much as possible?
Yeah, very interesting. So if we think about, you know, we've talked about the reduction in compaction, the reduction in erosion. Let's go to our third sort of bucket, if you will, where we're talking about building soil carbon. Mm-hmm. So you know, walk me through what's the thinking here in the mindset and you know, how do we actually pursue that and why do we want to pursue that?
Yeah, it's interesting to me that you bring up the word reduction, because I also think about reduction with regards to this idea of building soil carbon. And the reason why I think of reduction is because I think of reduction of certain practices. So we see nationally across Canada, especially in the West, in the prairie provinces, we are seeing an increase in soil carbon over time in like recent years. And a lot of that is because of a reduction of tillage and a reduction of practices like summer fallowing, right? So the building we're seeing is not so much because we're building, it's because we're decreasing the rate of loss, if that makes sense. We don't necessarily see the same building rate in, you know, Ontario and Quebec because of practices like tillage and stuff that might be practiced in a different way than we practice on the prairies, right? So there's that. There is still a kind of the reduction of tillage helps to build or slow the bleed or decrease the bleed when it comes to carbon. And then practices like proper fertilization, basically building anything to build biomass. The more plant you grow, the more carbon goes into the system, right? And so if you're not growing carbon, you can't put carbon in the soil. So a lot of those things are beneficial. More perennials in the system. And this is when, you know, dairy farmers can shine because of things like alfalfa and perennial forages for feed, because those shorter term perennials and things that move into that system are very helpful for, again, building carbon, because they are photosynthesizing for a long period of time. And during the time that it's in the stand, you have that reduction of the lack of tillage during that period of time. So the more perennials we have in the system, that's another way to build carbon. So we, a lot of times we build carbon by basically adding carbon into the system and decreasing the rate of loss of carbon.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And I really appreciate actually the thinking behind that in terms of the reduction versus building. I think it's a neat way to think about it and ties nicely to the practice that we've just been talking about. Something you haven't mentioned, and I can think of many different workshops I've been to over the years when we talk about soil health, the specific practices in my neck of the woods always brought up around cover crops and, you know, winter spreading of manure. And I realize that those get into other topics outside of what we've been talking about specifically, but is there a place for our conversation here to get into something like cover crops and, you know, how that, I presumably not being the expert here, I would expect that that's going to have some meaningful impact one way or the other here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say too, the reason maybe why I didn't jump into it as quickly too, is because it may be more limited in the prairies. And it's understandable because we have a shorter growing season and we have a shorter shoulder season, right, for that. And then the question is always like, how much biomass do you need to grow from a cover crop in order to make an ultimate kind of benefit? And then how are you managing the cover crop? So if you have a longer growing season and you have more room, essentially, or time available to be able to get a lot of that cover crop growth, absolutely. Again, we're building carbon. The more carbon we can create, the more biomass we create over a year in a growing season, the better off we are. So cover crops definitely can have a role to play in the idea of building soil carbon, but we also have to think about how we terminate those cover crops then as well, because if we're terminating with tillage, then you've got that, you know, like, oh, we added some, but then we tilled it. And so we know that building the biomass is good, but tilling it loses some of that. And so we have to balance those two together. So I think where we have cover crops, especially ones with an overwintering, like that don't overwinter, winter kill, or we're terminating with pesticides or something like some kind of herbicide pass and then not tilling it in, that may have a more of a benefit just because of the fact that, again, building carbon versus losing carbon, right? And how do we balance those activities? So in the prairies, you know, we're still, the jury's still out a little bit on cover crops in terms of what the true benefit is in the long run. But I think Ontario and Quebec, again, longer growing season, different scenario, and probably have a lot bigger benefit to being able to incorporate cover crops into the system.
Yeah, I think that's the key point that I took away from that too is, and it's so true for things beyond soil too, is the trade-off. I mean, I think most farmers listening here, farmers we talk to are going, hey, you know, I want to reduce soil carbon, but I got to get in the field. And you already addressed it, right? There's certain times of the year we got to do this. So how do we minimize impact while still getting the job done, so to speak? And I think that trade-off conversation in the context of all facets of environmental management is so key.
Yeah. And if you are able to use a cover crop to decrease some of your tillage, then there you go. Right. If you're in a situation where you are more of a conventional tiller, but what that does is it helps you to create some sort of, you know, weed management by choking out weeds or something like that, that you can add in. If you're decreasing your tillage as a result of the use of the cover crop, now that's win-win, because now you've got less of the loss, as well as that additional biomass carbon addition.
Is it fair to say that I mean, you've spoken a couple of these points very explicitly already, but is it fair to say that pursuit of building soil carbon reduction and erosion and compaction, that there is a tangible return on investment for farmers that are listening here?
Yeah, I would say yes. And this is the one when is always, this question is always the hardest, I would say, as a soil management specialist, somebody who, you know, is promoting a lot of these different techniques and ideas for long-term sustainability, right? We're talking about building carbon, decreasing erosion, right? All of these decreasing compaction. We're talking about long-term sustainability of the soil for long-term production. And if we know that we're building that and we're creating that, then that in itself is a return, right? But it's also, this is the struggle that I always have as somebody who does extension in these areas, is that a lot of times the number one question will be asked is, well, if I do this, is it going to pay? How much more money am I going to make? What am I going to get out of it? And that's an answer that I unfortunately don't have. That's an answer that requires such long-term research in a way into this, right? And we never see research that goes on. I mean, I shouldn't say never. We often have long-term research, but it takes a lot in order to have really long-term funding to help support long-term kind of impacts. And so we know that there is going to be a benefit from a lot of different kind of productivity standpoint, things like that, but we don't really have a lot of data showing the economic return that comes from, you know, reducing tillage or improving the, you know, decreasing the erosion potential, decreasing the compaction potential. So theoretically, we know that they're great practices, and theoretically, we know that they are going to help us in the long term. And I often wish that I had a better answer when somebody says, well, is it going to pay? Because that bottom line is going to be a number one driver for a lot of decisions, right? And we can do all these amazing things for long-term sustainability. But if you are asked to invest a bunch of money into doing something, you need to know that that investment is going to be worth it.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And it's true for so many other facets of farming, not just land management. And a challenge for sure. We live in a world of wanting to quantify and know, you know, with certainty. And I can appreciate that. But also, I think you get back to those principles of we know these are the right things to do. We may not be able to hold the specific, you know, dollar amount in our hands, but we know that especially with an eye towards the future, these are key practices and key issues.
Yeah, I could even add too, another complicating factor to this is, do you own the land or do you rent the land?
Yeah, no kidding.
And that is always one that we talk about too, is because if I own the land, it's really easy for me to say, okay, this is a really great investment. I know that I'm maybe putting some money into this, but I want to keep it for the long term. But if I'm renting it, I don't have the same skin in the game, right? Like I don't have any guarantee that I get to keep that. So that becomes an extra complicating factor in this system. And as we see more and more people renting and not being able to necessarily purchase or own, that we need to see more long-term rental agreements. We need to see more conservation kind of clauses added into rental agreements. And a lot of farmers, I think, would be willing to work within those conservation clauses if it means that they can get a guarantee to be able to rent this piece of land for a longer period of time than 1 year, right? Because it gives them a little bit more kind of longevity to it. Because, I mean, rental from year to year is always a, it's always a struggle.
Now, not being the soil management expert in this conversation, I know enough to say that when it comes to assessing or our ability to assess, detect, and really dig into specific areas of, you know, of issues in the context of soil. So we're seeing low productivity. What's specifically causing that? What are the characteristics of the soil? I know we can do a lot of testing. We can do a lot of investigation. Mm-hmm. And many of those things start on farm and can move off farm because we have some pretty amazing technologies and collective experts that can look at things. Given our audience, you know, we're trying to speak to farmers here and talk about what they can do. If they are seeing that they've got, you know, specific areas or specific fields where they're seeing low productivity or issues, you know, any thoughts or recommendations for them short of talking to their advisors and getting more insight there?
Yeah. So when you see something, sometimes talking to your advisor is a good way to have a conversation about what might be the problem. I think we forget. Hopefully we don't forget, but I mean, the farmers who are listening, they know their land, right? They know more than anything what's going on there quite often because through the observation, we might not know the exact cause of the problem. And that might be where that investigation comes from, but we are able to pinpoint there is a problem here. I have low yield here consistently year after year. Sometimes I know what the problem is. It's an eroded knoll. It's a low-lying saline area. It is, you know, there's a whole list of things. Sometimes we see it, we don't really know what's going on. And that's when, you know, talking to your CCA, talking to some kind of advisor, talking to somebody who is, you know, trusted and that you work well with, they can help to investigate that and try to figure out the problem. So we start from there and then we start doing diagnostics, right? And there are, like you said, a number of tests and things that we can determine diagnostics for. Sometimes it's not even a lab test. Sometimes it's just going out and digging around in the soil. You know, when we talked about compaction, a lot of people will ask, you know, oh, should I buy a penetrometer so that they can press in and see how tight that soil basically is? I have a penetrometer somewhere in my office. I don't really know where it is right now, to be honest. It's not my favorite piece of like equipment. They don't cost that much. A lot of farmers would love to own them. They're easy to use in a way, but you need to actually use them regularly to get a feel for how to use them properly, because you can't just go out the first time and use it and be like, oh yeah, this is what the soil pressure is in my field. But you know what I can use every single time and is super cheap and easier than that? It's a shovel. I carry a shovel with me everywhere I go, and because that shovel is going to tell me what's going on. If I go into a farmer's field and they tell me, oh, I don't have a compaction problem, I hand them the shovel and I say, okay, you dig this hole. And very quickly, they get into, you know, that hard pan somewhere and they're like, oh, the soil's really tight here. And yeah, you do maybe have a compaction problem. So, and beyond, you know, the compaction, you can actually see the soil when you're digging. You can see the soil crumbling apart or not. You can kind of see what's going on. You can see the thickness of topsoil. You can make a lot of observations that way. I think the shovel is a highly underrated tool. And so it is a great way to just be able to go out and just keep an eye on what's going on in the field. Obviously, it's one point versus another, right? But it's something to keep in mind. In terms of a lot of the, you know, soil health diagnostics or things that we kind of look at as maybe not a diagnostic, but you know, some kind of indicator of change, organic matter and carbon buildup, you know, obviously are ones that we're often looking at. Those take a long time to build. They're really, really slow processes. We can't expect them to change really quickly. Aggregate stability, the stability of the soil, what those aggregates look like, they'll change a little faster. So we can see that visually. And you can even send soil off to a lab for things like aggregate stability. And one of the interesting ones from a carbon perspective is an active carbon test, permanganate oxidizable carbon. It's POXC, P-O-X-C. And that one is really just looking at active carbon. And we don't have good indicators to know like what the number is, whether that number is a good number or a bad number. We don't know enough about it yet. But the one thing we do know is that if you test one soil 1 year and then go back in a couple of years and test again. If the number's going up, that's a good thing. So it's relative. We don't have a way to relate it from one to another, right? On like an index, but we are able to say, okay, this is your field. This is your test. This is, it's going up over time. That means good things are happening. You're not, you'll see that happen faster than your organic carbon will go up or faster than your organic matter will go up. But it means that it is going up and will eventually kind of show promise. So it is kind of a shorter term indicator to be able to say, hey, something good is happening here. But again, a lot of times I think we forget about these cheap tools like shovels and our eyes and being able to kind of see and make a lot of observations and seeing changes happen.
Yeah. Simple and effective. I like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
One question I want to just slip in here, and you made me think about it when you talked about some of the sporadic and maybe characteristic weather that you talked about earlier on in the prairies. A big question we're all grappling with in all facets of life, are we seeing climate change present, you know, if nothing else, more extreme conditions that are challenging us on a year-to-year basis in terms of soil health? Big question. I'm not sure how much detail we can get in there, but I thought I'd throw it in there because it does, you know, in the context of sustainability, in the context of land management, it will be here for the long run. Is that something we need to be thinking about? Are we dealing with it today?
This is a good concept and a good kind of an interesting question you pose. I mean, a lot of what we talk about from a climate change perspective is variability and that increase in variability. We're seeing more extremes of moisture. We're seeing more, you know, more big storms and things like that. These large events, the swings, like what is normal anymore, right? And when it averages out over 30 years, it looks normal, but that doesn't mean that anything ever hit that normal period. And I think that's another reason why it's sometimes hard to put a dollar amount on these soil health practices, because really what you hope ultimately to come out of building soil structure at, you know, building organic matter, building carbon, building all these things in the soil is to build resilience and build a soil that is a bit more resilient in the face of these kind of extremes that happen within that short-term kind of climate impact. And the more resilience you have, again, the better able your system is to weather the storms, for lack of a better term. So there's a lot to be said for that. But again, it's hard to put that, like that's that economic gain or that return on investment. But really what we're trying to do with building soil is building resilience to deal with those. Again, it's, you know, somebody could say, well, if we had been no-till or had this land in a perennial, it wouldn't have washed away so bad. When you see how bad some of those erosion events were last summer, nothing can really protect fully from that, right? When we get some of these crazy extreme events, maybe we can't actually fix that or face that, I should say, just by having tackled, you know, these soil health practices. But it's those more minor things, that the ups and downs and the little glitches along the way, that hopefully we have an easier time kind of getting through the short-term dry cycles, the short-term wet cycles, because we have a soil that can soak up more moisture, hold more moisture, release moisture over time.
Well, I think it's well said, and certainly all of us can appreciate the importance of resiliency in the face of variability, and it certainly seems like that's going to increase at some reasonable rate of change based on what we've been experiencing. So I think that's quite interesting. If we bring it home, Marla, and think about, this is maybe a tough and maybe unfair question. What would be your recommendation to those listening here when it comes to soil health? Is for our farmers, is it, there is a practice you think you'd like to see the vast majority of farmers doing today, or is that the unfair bit? And really what we ought to have is more of a, maybe a mindset or an awareness or a perspective that, that we can apply and tailor to our fields, or is it all the above?
I think we can probably do a little bit of everything. If I was going to pick a practice right now, like one that I wish that I could see more people taking on, that soil landscape restoration idea, where we have those kind of history of tillage erosion, where, you know, the soil's been stripped off. I would love to see, like, that would be one that, again, because it's got a great return on investment, there's a lot of potential to move that soil back to where it came from and get some productivity back on those eroded knolls. Because if we assume that we're going to go to no-till and that soil is going to build itself again over time, it's taken a long time to get the soil to where it was to begin with. It's going to take a very long time to build that soil again. So repairing that damage essentially before adopting a no-till system. And even if you're in a no-till system, it's never too late to dig that soil and put it back up onto the top. So if there was a practice, that's one that, again, it doesn't apply to every single grower, every single farmer, because some of them are dealing with really flat land that might not see the same benefit or impact. But anybody who does have that, that's one I think just has such great potential and is a lot simpler than people think. So that would be there. In terms of like general recommendations, I think keeping records, if you're not already keeping records, like yield records and things like that, but I think just tuning the mind a little bit towards watching for these soil health things and having an understanding of what your concerns are. If your concern is things like compaction, then what we're going to do is we're going to figure out how to decrease the potential for compaction. And knowing that if the simplest thing that you can do is just not be driving randomly across a field, especially when you've got a wetter fall, and you know you're going to be causing compaction, especially if you're dealing with grain carts and things crisscrossing a field, driving down those tracks and trying to concentrate. So many practices or things that we can do might just be a little tweak, right? The soil landscape restoration, that's a big land moving soil around. But just tweaking little tiny things can make such a big difference. Like, again, for compaction, maybe cutting out a little bit of the tillage because we're thinking a little bit more about, well, this is the crop I've taken off. This is the residue I'm dealing with. This is what I'm planting next year. Maybe I need this seed bed and I'm going to achieve it in this way, as opposed to trying to create the same seed bed every year because we do the same amount of tillage. So it's just making these tiny, tiny tweaks. I think that sometimes what we do just, it's a natural thing for us to decide we're going to make a change, right? It's like New Year's resolutions. We're going to make a resolution. And what do? We pick this big wild thing and within 3 weeks, it's totally gone because we can't stick with it, right? But when you make those little tiny tweaks, that's all you're doing. And then you can build on those tweaks until you've got some, you know, you've moved towards something new and something with that idea of change in mind. So little changes, I think, are so much easier to commit to. If we try to adopt a system or shift the system to something that you can't commit to in the long term, it's going to fail. So tweak those little bits, add the little kind of soil health thoughts in your head as you move towards, okay, what do I want to achieve now? And you may be moving slowly into a bigger change, but you're doing it kind of like baby steps, and it makes it a lot easier to get to that point.
Yeah, it reminds me of just how do you eat an elephant, right? One piece at a time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Need a bit of a vision, need certainly a plan, but not to try and do it all in one fell swoop. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you said something earlier on around we didn't get to where we are, you know, overnight or in a short, it took time to get where we are, good, bad, or indifferent. And it's going to take time for us to move towards whatever that next outcome or next goal is.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, Marley, I think that covers off a whole host of topics. Really appreciate your insight. I think such a complicated topic, complex topic, and obviously a variety of tailored solutions that are required on a lot of farms. And I think you've offered some really good pieces that we can maybe rise above some of the detail and just think again, how do we think about some of these things? Why are they important? What does it mean to be talking about return on investment? And mm-hmm. why ought to we be putting in some of this effort around some of these big picture things that we can't always sort of see, feel, and hold in terms of return? So thanks so much for sharing with us and sharing with our audience.
Yeah, no problem. This has been a lot of fun. And like I said, soil is something you get pretty passionate about. There's a lot of fun things about it, but it is, like you said, the complications of it is what makes it so interesting as an area to work in. And it's, I always say to, when you work in soil management, half of my job is, you know, coming up with solutions and working with farmers through their problems. And half of it is come lay down on my couch and tell me your problems, because we have to talk about the problems first so that we can start working on solutions. And there can be a lot of problems sometimes when it comes to the soil. But again, that's what makes this type of position so much fun.
That's great. Thanks again.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks for listening to the Dairy Farmers of Canada's ProAction podcast series. I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, please visit www.dairyfarmers.ca/ProAction. And don't forget to like and subscribe for more content. You'll find us online at dairyfarmers.ca or anywhere you find podcasts. This podcast was narrated by me, Stephen Roach, produced by Aaron Winans, and edited by Carly Wright. Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. This project is hosted by the Dairy Farmers of Canada and is funded by the Canadian Agricultural Partnership, a federal, provincial, territorial initiative.